Frank Muir goes into nostalgia and investigates the humor of the subject with the help of Alfred Marx.
Two old men sitting in the park. They see a pretty girl walking past.
Charlie?
Aye?
Aye, here. You remember that stuff they used to put in our tea during the boardwalk to keep our minds off it?
Yeah.
I think mine's beginning to work now.
A couple celebrating their golden wedding, they decide to go back to the hotel where they spent their honeymoon. They're retiring to bed. The wife chuckles. The old man says, what are you smiling at, darling? She says, do you remember on our honeymoon? You devil, you hardly gave me time to get me socks off. She says, don't worry, darling, you've got time to knit yourself a pair tonight. Frank?
Yeah?
Frank, I don't know whether you knew this, but my great-grandfather fought with Wellington in 1810, you know. My grandfather fought with Redvers Buller in 1870, and my father fought with Kitchener in 1916, and I, myself, fought with Monty in 1943.
Your family doesn't seem to have been able to get along with anyone.
I say, excuse me, is your name Ponsonby Smythe?
Look in my diary. size 8 gloves. Yes.
Look here. Were you in India before the war?
India. Yes.
Was it Pune, 28?
Pune, 1920. Yes.
Did you know Lady Carruthers Pike?
Lady Carruthers Pike. Just a moment. See. Yes.
Did you have an affair with her?
Just a minute. Yes.
Yes. Well, I'm Lord Carruthers Pike, and I don't like it.
Just a moment. Yes, neither did I.
You remember that fellow Winthrop when you were out in Rio? Great chap he was.
Winthrop? I remember. Yes, Winthrop. What's he up?
Well, the last thing I heard, he'd gone completely off his rocker. Gone off into the jungle to live with a monkey.
God, fancy that. God. How things have changed.
Was it a male or a female monkey?
Well, a male, of course. Nothing funny about Winthrop.
Okay.
You know I was in a crack regiment, Lionel, don't you?
Not as good as the lot I was in, Rollo. We were the best drill squad in the world in those days. When we presented arms, all you could hear was slap, two, three, slap, two, three, slap, as one man.
Oh, well, a lot was better than that. When we present arms, all you could hear was slap, two, three, slap, two, three, slap, two, three, jingle.
What was the jingle?
Medals.
In this series of 10 programs, of which this is the first, we'll be going into various aspects of human nature and investigating their humour. And for those of you who missed the opening announcement or were doing something more important, we're starting off with nostalgia. It's always a good idea to start with the past, as Shakespeare put it in Henry IV, Part 2.
Past and to come seems best, things present worst.
Yes, I'm sure there's a lot of the appeal of looking back. It sort of takes your mind off the reality that faces you. It's sheer escapism. And the worse the present becomes, the more attractive former times are. Nowadays, the nostalgic cycle is getting shorter and shorter. Plays and films are being produced about the 50s and even the 60s. And people are buying the bric-a-brac 10 years ago at vastly inflated prices. Soon the cycle will speed up so much that some intelligent person will write a modern show that's nostalgic as soon as it's written. Nostalgia booms really a bit of a sad comment on the current state of the world. It's in times of real uncertainty that people look back with such intensity to the apparently more fixed standards of an earlier time. Things must have been better then. Here's Lord Byron.
The good old times, all times when old are good, are gone.
Gone, all gone, Alfred. But it's not just that things are particularly bad at the moment. Mankind always has looked back. Every civilization has its epic poems recounting the deeds of long-dead heroes and shares the feeling that the present can only produce sort of pale imitations of former glories. Some people, of course, always live in the past, like the lad in the poem by Walter de la Mare.
Do deedle die do, poor Jim Jay got stuck fast in yesterday.
Poor Jim.
There's a very nice comment in John Osborne's Look Back in Anger about the British upper middle classes.
They spend their time mostly looking forward to the past.
There's also something rather poignant about nostalgia, isn't there? Half of its attraction is wallowing in sadness, regret for the good times, even if they didn't seem particularly good while they were happening. In the words of François Villon,
Où sont les neiges d'antan?
Où sont, where the snows of yesterday? Où sont les neiges d'antan? Petula Clark sang a song about it. How did it go?
Da 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 da.
Dom Tom. That's right. Well remembered. Here's a whiff of more sentimentality from Oliver Goldsmith.
O memory, thou fond deceiver, still importunate and vain, to former joys recurring ever and turning all the past to pain.
Beautifully read, Alfred, thank you. It makes you think of the philosophical remark of some anonymous graffiti artist.
Nostalgia isn't what it used to be.
But then it never was. Perhaps it's wrong to analyse the past. Here's a report from the Morpeth Herald.
Alderman G. Doddridge said it was no use holding a post-mortem on something that was dead.
How right you are. No, it's much better to look back on the rosy mists. Because it's difficult to say, isn't it? The rosy mists of childhood. And remember how things perhaps were. Lord Byron.
Ah, happy years. Once more, who would not be a boy?
Perhaps a girl. Further, some lines from Thomas Hood.
Oh, when I was a tiny boy, my days and nights were full of joy. My mates were blithe and kind. No wonder that I sometimes sigh and dash the teardrop from my eye to cast a look behind. Oh, for the lessons learned by heart. I, though the very birches smart, should mark those hours again, I'd kiss the rod and be resigned beneath the stroke and even find some sugar in the cane.
How he managed to work that out. The happiest days of your life, though, the school days, or not, as your particular case might be. With so many subjects for nostalgia, like school, no one else's experiences are quite as good as our own, are they? Here's Samuel Pepys.
February the 4th, 1662. To Paul's school, it being opposition day there, I heard some of their speeches, and they were just as schoolboys used to be of the seven liberal sciences, but I think not so good as ours were in our time. Went up to see the head forms posed in Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, but I think they did not answer in any so well as we did.
One's own childhood memories are sacrosanct. They're very deeply personal to us. Here's a scene of the Glums from Take It From Here. Ron has lost his memory, and Pa Glum and F are trying to bring it back with recollections of his boyhood.
Just look round the walls of your bedroom, beloved. Don't any of the things there remind you who you are?
No, miss.
Miss? How to think I'd lived here, my Ron call me miss. Mr. Glum. He's forgotten everything.
Well, not quite everything, eh? At least he didn't call you mister. Ronnie, I'm talking to you now. Look round the room. All them treasures and trophies, they're all yours, you see? They all have the inscription, Property of Ron Glum.
Okay.
It's you. I've been telling you all night. You're Ron Glum. You are Ron Glum.
Oh, yeah. I'll forget my own name next.
Ron, have a look at all these little treasures, beloved.
Yeah.
Think about them. One of them might just do the trick.
And in that framed certificate up there, son, you can't have forgotten how proud you was of that. Given to Ron Glum by the Labour Exchange as a reward for regular attendance.
The Labour Exchange?
Yes.
No.
Oh, it just don't seem possible, do it? Them long, carefree hours leaning up against the A to G wall. All just gone.
How about your collection of cornflake packet faces, Ron? Oh, look, all this. The torch that goes three different colours if it had a bulb in it. Oh, Ron, look. This is something you've had since your 12th birthday. Your conductor set.
Conductor set. Conductor set.
Oh, does it ring a bell, Ron?
Just a minute. Yes.
The Glums. But things change as you get older, and even their names are no longer recognisable. A report from the Daily Mail.
Mr. C. Adams, chairman of Warberswick Suffolk Parish Council, called a titter-totter a butterwats when he was a boy. I suppose most people call it a seesaw now, he told the council yesterday.
Oh, they used to have great fun on the titter-totters in the old days. Say nothing of the butterwats. But as boys, they're not suitable for adults. Here's an adage from H.J. Byron.
This gardener's rule applies to youth and age. When young, sow wild oats, but when old, grow sage.
Well, Byron, didn't he write pantomimes in couplets, rhyming couplets?
I never got a reply.
Let's hear now from a character who could never quite reconcile himself to his present, preferring to look back to worthier times, the 17th century antiquary John Aubrey.
Some of these curiosities in this chest are so exceeding old that no books reach them. Here it is. When Father Harcourt suffered at the stake at Tyburn, his bowels, etc., being thrown into the fire, a butcher's boy, standing by, resolved to have a piece of his kidney, which was broiling in the fire. He burnt his fingers, but he got it. One Royden, a brewer of Southwark, bought it. The wonder is, 'tis now absolutely petrified. Oh, 'twas not so hard when he first got it, but being carried in the pocket, hardened by degrees. Like an agate, polished. I much value it.
Roy Dotrice as John Aubrey. Not everyone views the past with respect, and some aren't afraid to speak ill of the dead. Here's a little 19th century rhyme by Walter Savage Lander, which may reveal why he had that middle name.
George the First was always reckoned vile, but viler George the Second. And what mortal ever heard any good of George the Third? When from earth the fourth descended, God be praised that George is ended.
Actually, they started up again, didn't they? Well, a vicious little biography brings us on to the whole subject of memoirs. The cause of their unfailing popularity must be nostalgia, memories of people and events which strike a chord in the reader's mind. One particularly common form of this is the literary reminiscence. Here are some memories of the Bloomsbury Group.
In the 20s and subsequent 30s, it was the ambition of every literary-minded young man to be invited to one of Virginia Woolf's Sunday morning soirees. These were invariably held at her home, number 52 Tavistock Square, to which I was a frequent visitor, for I was distantly related to the Woolf family through some Alsatian cousins. The door of number 52 was invariably opened by the maid, George, a friend of Lytton Streech's. I can see that room now, full of talk and smoke and people, and what extraordinary people they were. Elliot was there, Spender, Auden, and Isherwood, the old faithfuls and the young hopefuls, but always though someone one never quite expected to see. I remember seeing E. Houseman there once, lured down from Cambridge by Daisy Rylands and the prospect of All In Wrestling at Finsbury Park. And there by the window, talking to Leonard and Virginia, were the Berlins, Irving and Isaiah. And then there was Virginia herself, elegant and quizzical, her great nostrils quivering, the sunlight playing over that long, pale face. She would be talking of her contemporaries, how she'd spoken last week to Hemingway. Now, Ernest had said, "When I reach for my gun, I hear the word culture." How easy it was for him, she thought, and how hard it was for her. Some of her work, you see, frankly disappointed, vitiated by her intense feminism. Virginia was never a suffragette, but she subscribed to the theory that the pen was mightier than the sword. And I once saw Evelyn Waugh reel under a savage blow from her Parker 51. But of all the honors that fell on Virginia's head, none, I think, pleased her more than the Evening Standard Award for the tallest woman writer of 1926, an award she took by a short neck from Edith Sitwell. And rightly, I think she was, in a very real sense, the tallest writer I've ever known, which is not to say that her stories were tall. They were not. They were short. But she did stand head and shoulders above her contemporaries, and sometimes, of course, much more so. Oh, Dylan Thomas, for instance, a man of great literary stature, only came up to her waist. And sometimes, not even there. If I think of Virginia now, it is as she was when I last saw her in the spring of 1938, outside the changing rooms in the London Library. There she stood, all flushed and hot after a hard day's reading. Impulsively, perhaps, I went up to her. "It's Mrs. Wolfe, isn't it?" "Is it?" she said. She looked at me out of those deep, limpid eyes. "Is it? I often wonder." And she wandered away.
Superb piece from Alan Bennett. We're always intrigued by how people used to live. Famous people, even non-entities. What were they like? Well, one source of information is what is said about them on their tombstones. Sometimes a little flash of character that opens like a casement on a former age. Alfred has some examples about his person. First, here's one from Oxfordshire.
"Here lies Stephen Rumbold. He lived to the age of 101, sanguine and strong. 101, you don't live so long."
Wouldn't take that bet on. Here's one from Aberdeen.
"Here lie the bones of Elizabeth Charlotte, born a virgin, died a harlot." "She was aye a virgin at 17, a remarkable thing in Aberdeen."
All letters of protest on tartan paper to the producer. Here's another from north of the border.
"Here lies my good and gracious auntie, whom death has packed in his portmanteau."
Love that one. I don't know, it's funny. Nostalgia is a growth industry in Britain today, and its most rapidly developing section is that related to the last war. Films, plays, television series are endlessly going back to that time, and there's even a great Second World War souvenir trade. Some people prefer to keep things from earlier wars. A letter from the old Sunday Pictorial.
"I have in my possession a tin of bully beef issued during the 1914-18 war. I keep it on the mantel shelf and it appears to be as fresh as ever."
It probably is, considering how fresh they were to start with. I suppose the attraction of the last war for those who took part in it and survived is a friendship that was formed there. Well, that story, wasn't there a story, Alfred, about the fellow who was went to see his commanding officer?
Oh, yes.
Sir, my friend, Private Clare, was posted to North Africa.
Yes, sir. That's right, yes.
I'd like to have a posting, too, to North Africa, sir.
Why?
I want to be near my kit. That sort of comradeship, of course, went on during the war. Then after the war, years after, came the reunions. Those great get-togethers of ex-comrades-in-arms.
Did I ever tell you about the time in Bengali?
Yes, hundreds of times.
When Smudger got... I'll never get this out. When Smudger got the chicken out of the cooker...
Yes, you told me.
And he stuck it up his blouse and he ran off.
Yes, I know about that. You told...
And the officer started up, well, that man running away with the chicken started up his blouse.
Yes, I know. You told me that one.
And Smudger yelled out, Hancock! Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. I'll never forget that. Laugh.
You got court martial for that, didn't you?
Yes. He was a guard. He was always doing things like that. You couldn't help liking him. I did about 2 years for him, on and off. Did I ever tell you about the time we got drunk in Naples?
Everybody got drunk in Naples.
Not like we got drunk. Roaring stiff we were. Rigid. Couldn't stand up. Up to here in Chianti we were. Standing on top of Vesuvius, pouring in bottles of vino redo. Nearly put it out. Just as I'm in battle. There we were, dug in, just outside Anzio, and the order came through, retreat on all fronts.
Retreat.
I looked at Smudger. I said, which way is Berlin? He said, that way. I said, right, that's the way we're going. So we put the lid on our toffee tin, and we were off. Me, Smudger, Ginger and Chalky, marching towards the whole might of the German army. Rifles at high port, bayonets drawn, one up the spout, singing the regimental march. Well, there it was. Death or glory. When the Germans realized we meant business, they threw everything at us. They brought up their 88 millimeters. One pointing at each of us. Hands up, they shouted. Over the megaphone. Well, that did it. We assembled our 25-pounders. 25-pounders against 88 millimeters. The only chance we had was to try and shoot their shells down before they landed. Or, better still, put one down the barrel of their guns and hit their shell just as it was coming out. Thus putting them out of action. It's a bit of a scene. We moved forward slowly, slowly edging forward till there we were in the inky blackness, 10 yards away from them. One giggle, one laugh from any of us could have meant death. Then, tragedy, tragedy. We hadn't brought our shells with us. Now there was only one thing for it, hand grenades. We pulled the pin out with our teeth, rushed forward, chickety stitch, and threw them. What an explosion, right on their ammo dump. I've still got a piece of metal inside me.
You have?
Yes, I swallowed the pin.
A right and proper for Tony Hancock and Sid James to bring to a finish our programme on nostalgia. Next week, Alfred and I will be going into the subject of heroism. So until then, we'll sit and remember the beginning of this programme. Wasn't that joke about the old lady's socks grand, Alfred?
Splendid. They don't write them like that these
all
days.
Gone, all gone, all gone. Goodbye.
Goodbye, indeed.
Frank Muir goes into nostalgia, is produced by Simon Webb and John Lloyd.